Hi, my name is Susie and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I had to shake a little bit of the nerves out here right now just for a second, you know, because there's a lot of people still walking in. So I'll start off with my stats. I have a sobriety date, which is March 18th, 2018. And for that, I'm very, very grateful, right? I have a sponsor. She's very well aware of the fact that she's my sponsor. I'm very current with her. And I find that the more current I am with her, then that's it's kind of a reminder to me that daily I'm willing to take the test of honesty, right? And that I'm willing to take a test of integrity, you know, to, and integrity is important to me. I learned a lot of that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And integrity for me means showing up every single day and telling my higher power, who I choose to call God, that I'm ready to accept the challenge of being who I tell him that I'm going to be. But in order for me to do that, I had to clearly define that, and that took a lot of work. I have a home group, which is the Inland Group in Redlands. We meet on every Monday night at 7:30 p.m. I get there at 5:30 p.m. because I get to be the secretary of that meeting. That's also an honor and a privilege. You know, for a drunk like me who didn't even want to be in meetings to begin with, you know, to be a secretary of such a loving group of people, right? I'd like to welcome the newcomers, right? Thank you guys for raising your hands and for identifying for everybody with less than 30 days, and for anybody in this room that raised their hand as an alcoholic, right? Thank you. Thank you for being home, and thank you for welcoming me home. You know, there's a rhythm in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a music. You can hear it in the hallway. You can hear it outside while we're smoking. You can hear it while everybody just said what I heard to be the loudest serenity prayer I've heard in a very long time, right? I mean, it was God. What? Who? What? Like, where did that come from, right? But there's powerful music in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? When I come into an AA meeting, that's a lot like me just walking into a room and saying, you know what, I'm not afraid to be around people that I love, and that I'm actually happy to say that today I needed my life, right? And that wasn't always the case. I'd like to thank my friend Kevin for inviting me to come out here and speak for him, you know, and for Mark for inviting Kevin, and for Debbie and Jim for getting in the car, for my friend Michael in Georgia and Trenton. I love you guys. Thank you very much, Amy and Jason. You know, my heart is thrilled to look over here to the right and see, or to the left, and see all you guys just sitting here, you know, praying and hoping I don't screw up because I called them up by name, so you know who I'm with, right? I'd like to point out one thing before I get started. You know, I liked the fact that we introduced the people who were out of town, and I quickly caught on to the fact that Jason announced that he is from a place called Happy Valley, Oregon. Yet, it can't be that happy, because every time I see him on Facebook, he's somewhere else. He's not home. This guy is not home. He's either talking somewhere or playing golf or, you know, giving somebody a hard time. So I don't know what's too happy about his place. Maybe it's happy when he's not there. I don't really know. I don't know Jason that well, but, you know, it's an absolute honor and privilege. You know, I like our readings. The readings are that will keep me centered every single day. You know, I notice that we don't read chapter 5 in this meeting, and that's fine. I still cling to that, right? There's a lot of the things that I say in here that really resonate with me, you know? But one of the most important things I think that I said is that I'm an alcoholic. And I hope that I never forget that, because I know what forgetting that means, and I know where that leads me, right? In one of our readings that we didn't do tonight, it says no human power could have relieved us of our alcoholism. I truly believe that, you know, because I tried to be that human power, and that human power couldn't relieve me of my alcoholism. If I thought for a second that it would have come in the form of a four-year-old girl that I walked away from, a four-year-old daughter that I left with her mother in a hallway because I chose a drink over her. I chose a life that I needed. Right, so that goes to tell you that alcohol was my master, and it was for a very, very long time. So I'm going to get into my story a little bit. I'm going to tell you guys that I grew up in a, we like to call it an upper-lower class family, you know? Just meaning we had beans and rice, not just beans, you know, and homemade tortillas, because, you know, that was living, right? I mean, I knew lower-class families, you know, they only had rice. But, you know, I had two loving parents, one of them, which I'd figure out by the time I was 8 or 9 years old, was my stepfather, you know. But I grew up in a nice home, in a nice area, And, you know, I came out of the gate demanding anything that I think seemed reasonable for any, you know, only child, right? I wanted that bike, I got that bike. I wanted those shoes, I got those shoes, right? I wanted my parents' attention, I got their attention. It worked for a really long time until my two brothers and my three sisters realized and reminded me that I wasn't an only child. You know, but that's my alcoholism, right? It's the I, the self, and the me, right? It's the ism. I know that I suffered from alcoholism well before I took my first drink, right? I knew that my parents were struggling with me well before I even hit first grade. You know, I was the one child that my mom used to sit in her room, you know, behind closed doors crying about. You know, and I hear her praying to her God, what am I going to do with this child, right? And I knew she was talking about me. I gave them a hard time. It was just something that I did, right? What I didn't know, you know, what I know now is that I was restless, irritable, and discontent, right? I was very selfish and self-centered. I didn't care about anybody or anything. I only cared about my needs, right? And that at that time of my life, I was willing to go to any length to get that, right? I also grew up in a home where there was a lot of alcoholism, right? Yeah, they had their chance to escape. I took their chance to escape, usually grabbed their bottles, took them to the railroad tracks, cracked open some beers with my cousins, you know, on poker night. And that happened every Friday night in the home that I grew up in, you know? We talk about the progressive nature of this disease. I remember when my uncle used to show up in his Cadillac, and it would just be a casual poker night. A few months later, he'd show up in his motorhome, right? And that meant by the time everybody was getting drunk, we were off somewhere in Mexico, right? They'd pack all 12, maybe 15 of us kids, take us to Mexico, leave us on the beach stranded by ourselves while they went to these bars and they partied. I, too, came home to a lot of fighting parents, a lot of holes in the walls. We didn't have a lot of art. We didn't have a lot of pictures. We had a lot of holes. We had a lot of photos in our hallway, but that was to cover up a lot of the holes that were there. You know, my parents fought constantly, you know. That's just a little bit about what my childhood was like. You know, you kind of can get from the grips of it that, you know, I'm a lot of this, what the big book describes as self-will run riot, right? I had to have my own way. You know, at the age of 17 years old, I was able to kind of work myself into an early out program, let's say. You know, I was 17 years old when my mother asked me, she gave me a choice. Either I was going to live under their house, under their rules, or I had to leave, right? As a person who was to become an alcoholic, just like our big book describes, there's a lot of me in chapter 3, there's a lot of me in the doctor's opinion. At 17 years old, I moved out of that house. I wasn't even finished with high school yet. But I was done with those people. I was tired of relating to them. I didn't want anything to do with them. And at that point, my parents had two younger sisters that were 9 and 8 years younger than me. That was hard for somebody like me to take because for a very long time, I was the baby of that family. I made sure that when I was living there up until I was 17, that I didn't have anything to do with those kids. They were not my sisters. They were my stepdad's kids. It moved me further and further away. 17 years old, I moved away. I did what any strong woman of 17 years of age would do, and I packed a backpack and what would be a little carry-on box, and I moved a whole block and a half away. The only thing behind that is that I moved on the other side of the tracks. So if you grew up where I grew up, living on that side of the tracks is a lot better than living on the south side of the tracks, right? So I had something to show. I continued to work in high school. I continued to stay in high school. I managed to graduate somehow. I actually got a job when I was 17 years old, so I was making my own money. And I would, you know, skip along to the bank, you know, every other Friday, take my little $86 check to the bank and cash it, sometimes run into my mom and my sisters, and I would ignore them. I was bigger than them. I was better than them. I didn't need them. You know, my mom would walk around. She had these two young girls with her who were maybe 10 and 11 at the time, you know, and they would wave and say hello to me, and I ignored them. Wanted nothing to do with that life. At 17 years old, at 18 years old, I managed to graduate from high school, and I managed to get a diploma and a fake ID, right? Those were the two things that I needed because I was going to be successful. So at that young age, I was no longer sneaking into bars or standing outside of 7-Eleven asking somebody to buy me a big old bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill that I could sneak in a backpack and take into a movie theater and drink how I wanted to, or go hang out with the guys in the neighborhood who we affectionately referred to as the wall boys, meaning they all sat on a wall and smoked weed and drank out of paper bags, but those were my people, right? 18 years old, you know, I pretty much considered myself an adult, right? At that time in my life, you know, I noticed that the drinking, oh my gosh, that it just managed to progress, right? I wasn't seeing it, right? I wasn't seeing that the life that I was living wasn't normal, you know? That I pick up the phone and I call my house every once in a while just to check in, usually to ask for money, right? Because if they expected me to show up to a party, whether it was a birthday party, a baptism, a wedding, you name it, they wanted me there, somebody had to furnish my clothes and my gas, because I couldn't afford it. Granted, I had a job, but all my money was going to alcohol and outside issues. I managed to keep a job. I was not really good at it. You know, back in the, I'm going to say the late 80s, early 90s, I think that I created the hybrid schedule. The work from home schedule, you know, can't we just forward the phones to my house and I'll pick them up if my phone happens to be working? You know, it wasn't always the case. I never showed up to work on Mondays unless I needed an advance on my paycheck, right? I very rarely put in an 8-hour work day when I was there Tuesday through Friday. I was lucky if I did 4 hours of work, you know, and 4 hours trying to recover from the night before. Man, I moved from place to place. Everybody in my family knew that if they needed any information about me to send me a birthday card or take down my phone number, it had to be done in pencil. I couldn't keep a phone number, I couldn't keep an address long enough for anybody to find me, right? And that's alcoholism. That's geographics beyond measure, right? I still have family members who tease me about that. They're like, yeah, I've had the same phone number for 10 years. I'm like, yeah, I'm responsible, I'm an adult, you know? And it's true, so. You know, I watched my life kind of take all these different turns and all these different directions. You know, my alcoholism got really bad. I started going through what the book describes as pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. By the time I was 24 years old, you know, I was not living in my apartments as much as I was living in my car. And if I wasn't living in my car, I was staying at your house with your wife or your husband. Don't judge me. It didn't matter. You know, it was just, you know, this was not by choice. This was by this. Right? What was I going to do? How was I going to find somebody to love me? But basically the reason I did that was because I had to find a way to get a fix, right? By that time I had graduated from Boone's Farm and into, you know, a nice fifth of Southern Comfort, you know, not the big bottle. You know, I like going to the liquor store every single day and picking up a fifth from the freezer, right? That was my go-to. I hid them everywhere. I hid them in my closet. I hid them in my shoebox. I hid them in vents, I hid them in wherever, because I couldn't let people know that I was living with or that I was staying with how I was drinking, right? I managed somehow, right around the age of 26 years old, to get myself into what I call my first series of criminal events, right? I mean, not really, kind of, sort of, but I was coming off of a 9-day bender, right? I hadn't eaten anything, probably hadn't slept, you know. There was a lot of accelerants that were introduced into my life that helped me drink. Right, a lot faster. It just meant that I went to the liquor store 2 or 3 times a day to pick up that fifth, right? And I managed to get myself in trouble in June of 1996. I was arrested by the Long Beach Police Department on a domestic violence charge, right? I went in, you know, not one of my friends showed up the next day to see how I was doing, to pick up that county phone. Nobody was interested in anything. I was getting restless, I was getting more irritable, I was discontent, I was panicked. I was completely fear-stricken. I did not know what to do. So I did what any 26-year-old would do in that case, being 9 years away from home. I picked up the phone and I called Mommy. And my mother picked up the phone and she managed to call my brother, who's a police officer. They pulled some strings and they got me in front of a judge that following Monday. At that point, a restraining order was put on me, you know, and I was forced to go live with my sister in her little 2-bedroom apartment with her family, who's married with 2 kids, you know, and I was there to share a room with my niece. You know, at that point I had, for some reason, I just didn't feel like drinking. I was humiliated. You know, my brother had to pick me up and take me to Mervyn's because there was a restraining order on me, so I couldn't walk into my own house. I couldn't get any clothes. My brother took me to Mervyn's, brought me some undergarments and a fresh set of some clothes just so I could make 4 or 5 outfits out of it, right? So I knew at that point that it had something to do with the drinking and it had to do with the using, and it'd probably be best if I put that aside for a little while. And I did. So I didn't have a problem with it. I walked away from the drugs, I walked away from the alcohol, and I reengaged with my family. And it was beautiful, right? I had an opportunity at this point to get to know those two little girls that were my sisters, and I got to listen to the music that they listened to. I got to watch the movies that they watched. I got to pick up the phone and ask them how they were, how their day was at school. You know, I talked to my mom. She got closer to me. She wasn't angry with me. She just somehow, some way knew that this was the path that was laid out for her daughter, and she knew that I made the choice at 17 years old, and that there was nothing she could do about that, right? I managed to get really engaged in this family dynamic, and had the best time of my life, up until right around November 3rd, 1996, when I picked up that phone in the middle of the night, and it's that phone call that nobody wants to get, only to find out that my mom and my sisters, on their way home from Rancho Cucamonga from celebrating some birthday parties, never made it home. You know, their SUV rolled over on the 15th freeway, and my family was gone in an instant. And not only that, but with them, and with their funerals, and with us putting them to bed and putting them back in God's hands, I knew that part of my life was gone. And I knew right then and there that I didn't want anything to do with it. I didn't believe in love. I didn't believe in family. The only thing I believed in, my only solution, was to go back out and do what I was doing. So within weeks of the funeral, within weeks of the burial, not caring whether or not my stepfather was home by himself, I picked up, grabbed it out of the backpack, and I was out on the run, right? I stayed on that run for another 3 or 4 years, and I got tired, right? I got tired of moving again from place to place, waking up on people's couches, waking up, you know, on the side of liquor stores, sometimes on park benches, you know, sometimes in a park in the middle of the street, with things that are happening to a woman my age that shouldn't be happening to a woman my age, in the middle of a park in the middle of the night. I'm up and I'm looking for my clothes, I'm looking for my money, I'm looking for my wallet, and I can't find anything. But whatever I had on me was sufficient enough for me to get over to that liquor store and get that next bottle and drown it away, right? For some, we were just talking about it, Rachel and I called it the magic, right? All these little magical moments happen. You know, in 1999, I was introduced to somebody who would later become my wife, right? Somebody that I actually met, somebody who I took an interest in, somebody that I began to felt a little bit of that sense of love, right? I did everything that I thought I could do, and I told myself, I can do this time. I can get married, I can buy a house, I can have a kid, I can stop drinking, I can put that bottle away. And I did all those things. You know, my older brother called our relationship, he called us the Cleavers, because all my other brothers and sisters got married after their kids were born. They bought houses and decided to commit to relationships after the fact. I was the only one who did it right. I got in a relationship, I asked somebody to marry me, we bought a house, we had a kid, I was to live happily ever after. That was my mindset. That's what I thought could happen, right? However, a little close to 12 years into that relationship, after being married for that time, and for having that daughter, you know, in 2008, and by the time she was 4 years old, I got thirsty. I got thirsty, and I made up an excuse, and I started telling myself that it was time for me to go out and get that second job so we could get better things in our home. Let me take care of the family. Let me do these things. And all I did was go out and find a part-time job and became a softball director for like a co-ed league in the city of Claremont, right? And that was where my trouble was to start all over again. I didn't see it as trouble at the time. I finally regrouped myself with people who drank like me, with people who had responsibility but kind of threw it by the wayside like I did, you know? And they just didn't care about certain things, and I felt like I fit in, right? Before you know it, 3 or 4 months into that job, I'm bringing home good money in cash under the table. As long as I'm stacking that cash on that kitchen table, she and this child are gonna be fine. But I'm gonna go play in a softball tournament in Arizona that starts on Thursday, ends on Sunday, but I'm to be gone from Tuesday and come back the following Saturday. I'm leaving my house for 10, 12 days at a time, and I'm not coming back. And when I do come home, I'm purposely sleeping in another room, right? I don't want them to smell the alcohol on me. I don't want them to smell the disgust on me. You know, I don't want them to smell everything that I've done, people that I passed through, relationships that I've burned, not only my own, but other people's, right? I continued on that path until October of 2017, which was by the second time that I picked up my second DUI. The funny thing about that, although it doesn't sound funny, is I got my first DUI in April of 2014, right? I was arrested by the Claremont Police Department. And in October 2017, I was arrested by the Claremont Police Department. You know, we think we learn, we don't. I get arrested by the same cop on the same street, in the same car, in the same city, right? And I truly believe that, you know, and what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is that everything happens for a reason, right? That God has a hand in everything. Because I remember the second time that I got arrested, I remember the jailer who specifically remembered me, and she was asking me, haven't you had enough? And I said, haven't I had enough of what? She says, aren't you tired of living this life? Tired of living one life? You don't get it. I have to drink. Don't you know what's happened to me? I'm a victim, right? Don't you know what happened to my family in 1996? You know, were you even born in 1996? The girl looked like she was 12, right? She's not going to get me, right? She's not going to get me. So the day after I got that DUI in October of 2017, I was led into a lawyer's office in the city of Claremont as well, right? This gentleman started, you know, he took my money, right? You know, I paid him his retainer. It was a little over $5,000. The first thing he asked me was, do you have a drinking problem? My very smart aleck response was, obviously I do not. I have a driving problem. You know, that my stubbornness believes that I can get behind the wheel after, I don't know, 5 or 6 bottles of whiskey, you know, whatever the count was that night, right? I know that in April of 2014, my blood alcohol content was barely a 0.079. So I was like, I'm not even really legally drunk, but you know. But I know that in 2017, it was a 0.19, which is twice the legal limit. Twice, almost 3 times what I was 3 years before. So we talk about the progressive nature of this disease, right? The alcohol that I was drinking in 2014 and those amounts wasn't working anymore. I had to drink 3 times, 4 times harder just to kind of keep pushing those feelings down. So I ended up going to this lawyer. I gave him his retainer. He handed me a court card and asked me if I would be willing to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, at this point in your life, it's going to look really good in front of the judge if you finally concede, and you it's going to give you a better chance at not getting in as much trouble as you deserve, right? And when I say as much trouble as I deserve, my first DUI was simply a DUI. My second DUI was a DUI resisting arrest plus evading, right? So I was facing 3 different charges, right? And I ended up going to this meeting. My very first meeting was at the 502 Club in Covina. And I remember that I walked in and there was a greeting line, much like the greeting line here, a lot of people that were extending their hand, and I was very uncomfortable, right? You extended your hand, but I didn't feel like I was worthy to receive your hand, right? That, you know, I just didn't want anything to do with anybody at that point. I just wanted to go into that meeting and get that court card signed. What I didn't know is 10 minutes after sitting in that meeting, that lawyer of mine would walk in. And I looked over at him and he smiled at me. Right? He smiled at me, and what I know now is he was my Eskimo. You know, he brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous. It took me 5 months to get sober, you know, and the reason that it did is because I had zero interest in listening to, into working any steps, right? I walked in there, and the only thing I was interested in doing was looking for the differences and not the similarities. And I realized that 5 months that I did that did me more harm than good, right? Because for those next 5 months, I would be picked up a total of 5 more times for drunk in public, right? Because I wasn't driving, I was walking home, right? And granted, there's sidewalks, and I managed to always end up in the middle of the street, you know? But I was being responsible, so I wasn't walking, you know, home from the bar. I wasn't driving home from the bar, you know? And I still had a car in my driveway. I just knew, you know, to not do that. Those last 5 months were hell, you know? The Big Book talks about it, you know, talks a little bit about, I finally, after some really intensive work with my sponsor and listening to speakers, can really relate to that line in the book where it talks about our frightful drinking. You know, I was drinking to hide every single part. I was so ashamed of myself, right? And I was so embarrassed, and I didn't want to face my family. And I know that I couldn't call home one more time because I knew that my mother wouldn't pick up, right? And I knew that I'd be dealing with a stepfather who was already done with me, right? And I don't know, it took me a while. It took me a while of coming in and not even raising my hand as a newcomer. I never raised my hand as a newcomer. I never walked up and took a chip, right? I didn't want to really show my face. I came in hooded sweatshirts and baggy shorts and flip-flops. 9 times out of 10, I got dropped off by my friends who were waiting for me across the street at the bar, you know, blowing up my phone while I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, showing me pictures of my glasses waiting for me, or a picture that I need to get over there and pay for, right? And I couldn't wait. You know, it's like advertisement, right? I couldn't wait to get out of that meeting and run across the street and get that ride home and have that drink. And I did it. But I took that one drink that one night after the meeting, and that meeting, that drink took me into Tuesday. And there I was, back to missing work on Monday, not showing up for family or friends, not answering my phone, right? And it was frightful, right? I can tell you that honestly, that during that course of that time, I didn't want to live. I didn't like my life. I didn't like where it was going. I didn't like anything about it, you know? In March of 2017, I started feeling a little bit different. I started getting more tired, right? Tired enough for me to sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, tired enough to not pay attention to what was going on with my phone, and just open enough to start listening to the message, right? I started hearing things that I could relate to, you know? I heard a speaker who happens to be a really good friend of mine who shares a story about, you know, very early in sobriety, his wife was diagnosed with cancer, and a few months later she died. And I remember relating to how he felt and asking myself after I left that meeting, how did he not drink over that? How do you not drink over that, you know? And I remember that it touched me. And I remember that I started going to meetings a little bit more frequently. And I remember that I got a big book from another member at a Tuesday night meeting in the city of Upland, and in just a little group, right? I called it the crosstalk meeting because everybody just kind of yelled at each other. But there was a man who noticed me all the time sitting in the corner who pretty much knew that I needed a solution. And, you know, he handed me a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that thing sat closed on my shelf for months, right? You know, later on in March of 2018, I was to pick up my sponsor, you know, not on purpose. I didn't, you know, it wasn't a meeting like this. Can you raise your hand? Oh, they're a willing sponsor. Okay, I'll pick you. It wasn't like that. I was waiting outside of the meeting, and I was getting ready to walk home like I normally did when we had a conversation, and I just happened to ask this lady, so how do you ask somebody to be your sponsor? She said, you just ask them. I'm like, you just say, will you be my sponsor? She said, yes, I will. And she handed me a card. And I was like, what is this? You know? And she says, well, call me. And I remember calling her and talking to her, but not being quite comfortable, right? I was still shaking. I was still jittery. I was still trying to figure out. I couldn't go to sleep. I couldn't sleep, right? Couldn't go to work. I still couldn't eat. I was detoxing, and I detoxed on my own. And I don't recommend that to anybody, right? It's not healthy, you know? If I would have changed my mind at any given second and really just started believing this thinker in here, I would have been across the street, you know, with a handle of whiskey and a heartbeat and having to start this all over again, right? Having to wake up, you know, just feeling regret and remorse. And I finally called this lady, you know, and I'm one of those people who likes to take a note. You know, I take a notebook and I write a date. And that's very important to me because I like to go back and I look at stuff, right? And I remember when I called her, I wrote down April 8th of 2018. And I was brought to tears because that's my mother's birthday. And I said, okay, so God's got a hand in this. And that lady up there is still somewhere looking out for me, right? You know? And it was beautiful. It was absolutely beautiful. And we talked, and she told me what it was going to be like to have a sponsor, to go through the book, to get into the solution. She told me about steps 1, 2, and 3, which is basically, I'm the problem, there's a solution, and God, you know, that I had to start making a decision every day to seek that solution. And I did. I willingly did. For some reason, I listened to her, and I took to her. She's still my sponsor today. You know, we have a very, very close relationship. Later that night, I was to go to a meeting in that same little hall, and I was handed a reading, right? People wouldn't approach me, you know, I mean, they would approach me like you would in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I was so shut off to you, I just kind of sat in the corner and stuck to myself. And if I'd hide when they passed the readings out, you know, I was like, go out the back door, have a cigarette, just, you know, avoid this whole getting in front of a podium thing. And I remember somebody handed me a reading, and I sat there and I couldn't get through it. I couldn't get through it. I started crying. And I'm like, I don't cry in front of people I don't know. And I'm crying in front of a whole room of people. And the reason that I cried is because I read that part that said, you'll suddenly realize that God is doing for you what you can't do for yourself. Well, when I picked up that phone and I called my mommy in 1996, my mom said, I'm going to do this for you. But when are you going to realize that God is doing for you what you can't do for yourself? And then everything made sense. My life started to click. I knew those people who were coming into our home when I was a teenager that I thought that she paid more attention to, you know, than her whole family, were not the people that she was trying to place her kids with. She was trying to treat her alcoholism. You know, in 1996, my mom died with just over 14 years of sobriety, you know, and I ignored all of that. I didn't know what she was doing, and that in itself is a gift, right? So I remember doing that, and I remember getting very active. I remember going to my very first Friday night meeting in the city of Upland and being introduced to Debbie, right? Debbie took my hand, and I haven't left her side since. You know, she's been traveling this road with me for just over 6 years, and it's been beautiful. You know, so she says, get in the car, we get in the car, right? She says, let's go to a play, we go to a play. She says, let's go hear the speaker, we go hear the speaker, right? I immediately got into service, right? Because this is a program of action, right? My very first commitment was, you know, making coffee, right? And it was weird to me because I did not know how to make strong coffee like they made at these meetings, right? But I quickly learned it was 5 cups of water, 10 cups of, you know, coffee, you know? And I didn't really understand how that was going to keep me sober until I started seeing a lot of the newcomers come in and they were shaking and they needed that cup of coffee. Or sometimes I watched that old timer come in who just lost his wife and needed a cup of coffee. And I realized that people were relying on me and I had to be there. So I started walking to these meetings 20 minutes earlier than I needed to, right? I immediately got into the book. I started doing step work. You know, we know that steps 4 through 9 take care of our past. And my past was something I was not ready to face, right? I know that on a daily basis, I do step 10, 11, and 12. And that's what keeps me sober today, right? I know that I have a life that's beyond my wildest dreams, right? I told you guys that I'm the secretary of the Monday night meeting. That somebody who couldn't even muster up the strength to raise my hand as a newcomer 6 years ago is now secretary in one of the best meetings in the Inland Empire in Redlands. And I say that not only because it is, but because it really is. You know, come on down. If you're ever in Redlands, come on down. Come see us on a Monday night. You know, there's music in that room. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous has wrapped their arms around me, right? Why wouldn't I want to, you know, give it back, right? The Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a give mentality, right? I used to be a taker, and now I'm a giver. Right? And these are things that I did not know that I was even capable of doing, you know? I'll go into a story real quick, because I think I have about 10 more minutes, but this is kind of important to me, you know, tell you a little bit about what it's like right now, you know? I've traveled further from home than I ever thought possible, right? Just last year alone, I've been to Punta Cana, to the Dominican Republic on a sober vacation with some friends, and we had so much fun, right? I also had an opportunity to travel to Mexico City with my dad, right? The man that I walked away from, you know, when he was grieving the loss of his wife and his daughters, right? My mom and his sisters. My selfishness never saw the fact that he lost anything, right? Because he had a nice house to live in, you know? And the night that I got my DUI in 2017 was the night that my dad had gone to Mexico City with some family friends, right? And for months and months prior to that, he had begged me and asked me to go with him, and I found every nickel and dime excuse in the book to not go. You know, one of them was true, which was I didn't have any money, right? But it's just because I knew that he was going to take me away from my drink, right? And that I wasn't going to be able to enjoy myself the way I wanted to enjoy myself in Mexico, right? And I really didn't want anything to do with his family, you know, let alone him, right? And I wasn't going to reveal to him, you know, just how far down the drain, this child, this person who he chose to call his daughter when he adopted me at 2 years old, right? I wasn't about to show him what I had become when I left at 17 years old with that backpack, right, and a chip on my shoulder. And he ended up leaving to Mexico that same night that I picked up my DUI, and I thought to myself, wow, you know, none of this would have ever happened, you know, had I been able to get on that plane and go on that trip. But I'm actually grateful today that that did happen, that I didn't go on that trip, because if I would have went on that trip, I probably wouldn't be here tonight, right? Last year, I was able to make an amends to my father. Probably, I think it was like in May of last year. I sat down with him. I had a conversation with him. It went better than I expected it to go, you know? And one of the things he told me was that he didn't think I would end up like my mom, but he was glad that I did, right? He said for some reason, she felt the need to carry the message you know, to other people. And he said, I don't ever believe that her work was done there. And he says, nobody better to help carry her message, the same message that she received in the Rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous than me, right? So the one thing he asked me was to get my passport. So I got my passport, did not matter how much it cost. I did it as quickly as I could. And the day that it came in the mail, he booked a trip to Mexico City. So on August 9th of last year, I jumped on a plane and we went everywhere. We ate at the dirtiest front yard restaurant you'll ever eat, and to the most beautiful museums in the city of Mexico. We visited Veracruz, we visited Catemaco. There's just a lot of beautiful places in Mexico. We did more in 2 weeks than most people would do in a lifetime in a trip to Mexico City, right? But we had a purpose to go to that meeting. My dad's older sister was sick and she was dying of cancer. And when my dad asked me to go with him, he said, I don't want to go visit my family one more time by myself. He said, I want to take one of my kids with me, and I think it needs to be you. So I went on this trip with him. We spent 2 glorious weeks together. We picked up his other 2 sisters, and we took them everywhere. And these ladies are in their 80s and 90s, and they're in better shape than me. It's unbelievable, you know. But they're hard workers. It was very humbling, right? We ended up cutting our trip short by 3 days because my Aunt Stella had fallen gravely ill, right? We left Mexico City on August 22nd, and my Aunt Stella was to die on August 24th, right? I remember my dad calling me, and he was crying, and he was weeping, and he was in tears, and I didn't know how to be there for him when my mom died, but I sure know how to be there for him when his sister died. And that's not of my own doing. That's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's because of the person that you guys have made me today, right? By sharing my deepest and darkest secrets, right, and this pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, the trouble and scrapes that I never thought I was ever going to be able to get out of, right, that I was able to sit there and I show up for my dad. And the last thing my dad told me on the phone was, I'm very, very sorry that our trip had to end like that. And I said, on the contrary, Dad, I'm very, very happy that our trip had to end like that. And he said, well, why? And I said, because all my life I looked at you as this dominating male in our home who fought with my mother, who fought with us, who did his own thing, who brought in 2 other children, right? I didn't understand your life. And I said, but the first time in my life as a 53-year-old woman, I'm able to look at you and see the man that you were meant to be. Which you're a son, you're an uncle, you're a brother, you're a great uncle, you're all these things. You're much more than the dad and that little box that I put you in my entire life and that I hated you and resented you for, right? This man was everything, right? He had a family and I was able to see that. And it wasn't through my own eyes, it was through the eyes of God. You know, God gave me these eyes. God sent me on this path. The reason that I'm here is by the grace of God. I believe that 100%. The reason that I was able to go to Mexico was by the grace of God. You know, the reason that I do all these things is because I'm asked of it and because people do it for me. You know, so when I'm asked by Kevin to come into Lancaster and it's 110 degrees and I'm standing in a jacket, you know, and I'm really sweating, the answer is always going to be yes, right? When I'm asked to suit up and show up and sometimes put on a dress, I say yes. Not comfortable, but I say yes, you know. My great-grand sponsor always says, prepare to be divinely inconvenienced. I have been divinely inconvenienced several times, you know. But there were people in the room who extended their hand, right, who offered me their hope and their love, and they brought me home, right? I believe that there's rhythm, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I believe that love and service is our melody, and it's also our chorus, right? There's a beautiful song, right? Our stories are still being written, right? We sit here and we're wondering how the next bill's going to get paid or how am I going to make it through the next day. I fully believe that God provides because God provided for me, right? It's not lost on me that I have to get out there and do the work, but I'm willing to do the work, right? For me standing here right now, I'm not even worried about what's going to happen tomorrow because if I end this day sober, and there's a very good chance I am because Kevin won't let me drink, right? You know, and Debbie keeps an eye on me and so do my friends, right? That this day is going to end well, right? And for me, the win is already won. So every fear that I had coming in as a newcomer, not knowing what's going to happen next, doesn't really matter. I made it through day one, I made it through day two, I made it through month one, month three, right? I've got over 2,300 days sober, and that's unbelievable for a drunk like me, right? I get to wake up comfortable in my home, right? I still have a lot of yets, right? That 4-year-old That four-year-old that I walked away from, I haven't seen her. She's 16 years old, right? She goes by the name of Caitlin. She's the absolute love of my life, and I remember that she was born. When she was born, I looked at her, and I told myself, I can do this, right? I remember my alcoholism told me that I couldn't, right? But I know that when I come into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I share my experience, strength, and hope, and I take that action and I extend my hand, that does that. This is not going to not happen for me. You know, it may not happen tomorrow, may happen 10 years from now, I don't know. But all I know that I've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected, right? By the windows and the doors in these rooms, and from the love that I feel from each and every one of you guys. Thank you very much. Really.